I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 247, Writing Byzantine Fiction with Gordon Doherty. Today, we have an interview with historical fiction author Gordon Doherty. I was going through Audible's catalogue of books a couple of years ago to see what Byzantine fiction they had, and I was surprised to see a book called Strategos, which, as you know, is the Byzantine word for general. The historical fiction that I'd seen before that was either about Justinian or even earlier periods, or about the Crusades or 1453 itself. To see something set in the middle Byzantine period was really exciting, and I eagerly listened to the book. Strategos, Born in the Borderlands, is actually the first book in a trilogy following the story of Appian, a Roman boy with a mysterious past and a complicated future. Gordon will tell you more about the plot in our interview, but it's set in the build-up to the Battle of Manzikert, and it seems clear that Appian will have a part to play in the drama. I'm very happy to recommend the book, and so I was pleased to sit down across a Zoom call with Gordon and ask him questions about it. But we also talked about his career in general, and what advice he'd give to other writers of historical fiction. I know many of you have thought about writing something in the past or are in the midst of writing your own book about Byzantium or other periods of history. So I think you'll really enjoy hearing about Gordon's journey and the insights he has to offer. Also, stay tuned after the interview to find out how you can win a free copy of the book. Or, if you want to listen to the book, you can also get that for free if you're signing up for the first time at audible.com. Now, here's the interview. Hello, Gordon Doherty. Welcome to the History of Byzantium.
Hello, Robin. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Tell the listeners, let's start with a bit about yourself and your background, and then how you came to write historical fiction.
Okay, so, well, I was born and raised in Scotland, and here I remain, right at the northern edge of the Roman Empire. So right now, sitting in my writing office, I'm about an arrow shot away from the Antonine Wall. So it's a pretty evocative location. the writing journey towards historical fiction. So it depends how far you want me to go back. But so I could say the starting point was when I was a boy, 7 years old, and I was struck down with chicken pox. So I had to spend a couple of weeks in bed, as you do, feeling rotten. Fortunately, somebody gave me a big stack of books, including the complete Chronicles of Narnia. So I spent the 2 weeks essentially devouring that series, and it was thanks to that and the other books I read that I didn't feel half of the pain of chicken pox. It was just it taught me the magic and escapism, firstly, of reading. it was shortly after that that it came to me, you know, what would happen if I actually tried to write my own stories, if I picked up a pen? It's only now reflecting back on that that I realise that that was kind of the door opening. You know, picking up a pen and writing stories, you effectively become the magician, you know, the person that creates the magic. And that was just like a mind-blowing revelation. You know, to understand that you're not confined to the world around us, your imagination can take you anywhere. So that was the kind of the start of being a reader, then becoming a very, very kind of basic writer when I was little, writing short stories and sometimes just cartoons and things, you know, simple things. As I grew up, I did the sensible thing and got a career in information technology. Very, very, very quickly got bored of that and came back around to writing, just as a hobby in my spare time. But also, at the same time, I got heavily into reading history and particularly historical fiction. Sometimes sneakily during the day job. It doesn't matter if my old manager is listening because I am no longer in that day job. So yeah, it's all of this converged, and this was in my early 20s. And I felt this great compulsion to write one of those magical historical fiction adventures that I so much enjoyed reading. And that's where it all began, really. I kind of had, from the kind of childlike short stories and so on, I tried to move on to some of the great topics of history that I'd read about.
And how hard was it to become a published author?
It wasn't, put it this way, it wasn't the route I expected to take. So I went through hundreds, probably, of rejections. And I understand why, because the earliest stuff I wrote was, you know, it had spirit, gusto and so on. It just didn't have the finesse, you know, the experience strength on. But I learned through the kind of the hardship of that, I guess, to refine and understand the flaws in my own work, to kind of hone my craft a little bit. And then, you know, I thought, okay, still I'm not getting a bite from a publisher here. But around the same time, the self-publishing boom happened. This was 2010, 2011, roughly. And I thought, well, I've got to try to start somewhere. And I gave it a shot with my debut novel, Legionary. It's a late Roman adventure that went into the self-publishing machine and completely blew my socks off. I did not expect what happened, but it happened. People loved it and wanted more, and that just changed my life. And I'm so grateful for it. It's a brilliant profession, being able to write for a living.
So the title of that book, Legionary, gives us a clue that you were headed in a Roman direction. What eventually led you towards Byzantium as a subject for fiction?
It was late Rome at first, and then I was kind of lured down the route towards Byzantium. And it's a similar situation to the chicken pox. This was insomnia back in 2004, I think. Out of the blue, I just suffered several weeks of bad sleep. But fortunately, I had next to my bed Byzantium, the Early Centuries, the book by John Julius Norwich. I'd been meaning to read it for some time, and I was hoping, like any book, you know, I'll read a few pages and I'll drift off to sleep. And the opposite happened. I was absolutely riveted, absolutely riveted. It's something about Norwich's style. It reminds me a lot of the podcast. It's, you know, it's history, but it reads like narrative fiction. You've got everything you could want. It's tales of love and war, treachery, disaster, triumph, and all spiced up with some really gruesome accounts of eye gouging and nose slitting and all these lovely things that the Byzantines did to each other. So, yeah, I didn't get any sleep that night at all. And then the next night, and I wasn't bothered about that. I was you know, quite happy to have enjoyed my read. And then the next night, carried on the same, and I devoured the whole Norwich trilogy. It's the early centuries, the Apogee, and the Decline and Fall. So yeah, my head was just bursting with ideas about the rise and fall of Byzantium. You know, it was, people say it's not really Byzantium, it's the Roman Empire, which is very true. It's the continuation after the fall of the Western Roman Empire. So it really wasn't a change of subject for me, it was a continuation of a subject that I already loved. So I knew then, if I'm going to write any historical fiction, it has to be set somewhere in the long and twisting tale of Byzantium. It has to be there.
I read Norwich myself, so I can well imagine. What led you past all the stories all the way to the 11th century?
Well, so I actually first stumbled upon an early choice of the 7th century as the setting, and the Emperor Heraclius as the protagonist. That was the first thing that I actually snagged. And I think I actually wrote about roughly half a novel about Heraclius coming of age and his adventures, you know, roving deep into Sassanid Persia. And the thing is, this was my still very early days as a writer. And I think looking back on it, that attempt was more of an experiment, a kind of craft honing thing again. But I realised it didn't deter me from finding my niche in the Byzantine landscape. And so I parked a Heraclius tale, thinking, okay, I've kind of played with that. But it's about a year or so afterwards, I was attending a really well-led night course about the history of the Crusades. So as hugely interesting as the Crusades themselves are, I was more captivated by the events that were described in the East, the events that laid the stage for the Crusades, namely the goings-on in 11th century Byzantium, Anatolia, and Syria. So this was an age when, as you have described, when the expanding Seleucid Sultanate was beginning to press up and encroach upon what was a time-served but gradually more inward-looking Byzantine Empire. And all of this pressure would eventually lead to the infamous and bloody Battle of Manzikert. So, while the Battle of Manzikert, for anyone who's not familiar with it, it wasn't an apocalyptic or catastrophic battle, it was pretty bloody and most definitely what I would describe as catalytic, in that the result of the battle triggered the decline of Byzantium and kind of ushered in the Crusade era. And that fact just struck me as, this is such a pivotal period in history. And I tried to imagine myself as a living, breathing person in those times. And it was at that moment that the idea for the Strategos trilogy was born.
Fantastic. So I talked a little bit about the first book, Strategos, Born in the Borderlands, in our introduction. But it's a trilogy focusing on a young Roman man named Appian. And Appian is dealing with kind of physical and psychological scars from the past, and he's facing an uncertain future. And without spoiling too much, there's a prophetic element to the story. Story has a sort of almost like a fantasy element to it. I don't think I'm spoiling too much. This is historical fiction, but I'm very interested in what drew you towards those prophetic elements in the story, one of which is the haga, the two-headed eagle symbol, which people are familiar with from Byzantium. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more about those elements of the story?
Sure. So, yeah, it's primarily historical fiction. Yeah, there is a definite dash of fantasy in there. And that comes from probably one of my greatest influences, David Gemmell. So he's primarily known for heroic fantasy fiction. But some of my favourite works of his are those in which he tackles history with just like a vein of fantasy. For example, Lion of Macedon. That's an amazing book that follows Alexander's general, Parmenion. And that's just a masterpiece in that respect. It's solid, brilliantly told history with a real kind of dash of mystique and fantasy in there to just lift it. And I think that's what it is, really, is that just the right kind of sprinkling of fantasy element can really lift and colourise fiction. And just to be clear, by a dash of fantasy, I'm talking about things like dreams, prophecies, and maybe what you would call familiars, you know, people that are only visible to characters, as opposed to outright wizards, magic, dragons, that
yes. kind of thing. Well, I should say for the listeners' benefit that the elements you've put in are elements you see the edge of in Roman histories. That we've just been dealing with Manuel Komnenos, who had a great interest in astrology, and almost all historians indulge in the kind of stories that grow up after an event, where they say, oh, there was a man who predicted this would all happen, and then the king dismissed him and didn't listen to him, and then it all came true. So, like, it feels very Byzantine, the elements you've put in, I should underline.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way to look at it. It's a human thing. We all dream. We all have our superstitions and our kind of retrospective prophecies, as you say. And we all, well, maybe just I, but I think other people too, we often talk to people who aren't really there, you know, lost loved ones, for example. So these kind of, what we term fantasy elements are, they're all within the realms of the human psyche. So when we come to the Haga symbol in particular, so the Haga, for anyone who's unfamiliar, that's an emblem of a two-headed eagle, wings outspread. And it's a very ancient symbol that's been used throughout history. So, for example, as you may well know, the Byzantine Komnenos dynasty, the Holy Roman Empire, the House of Romanov, and even on the modern Albanian flag, they're all emblazoned with the versions of the Haga, the two-headed eagle. And even way, way back in the Bronze Age, in Anatolia, the Haga symbol was used by the Hittite Empire, supposedly as a sign of power and dominance over the land. And they carved this symbol into their city and fortress walls and in places on prominent points in the countryside, high up on cliffs and so on. And I was just captivated by the idea that some 2,500 years later, roughly 2,500, yeah, in the 11th century AD, the heroes of Strategos might look up and see one of these majestic old Haga reliefs on a cliff face. Now that was just spine-tingling to think of. And there is a symbolic element to it as well. It's not just the historical basis of the Haga symbol. So in terms of symbolism, the Haga practically chose itself for the trilogy because it represents the core theme of the story, that is of personal and cultural conflict. So to explain, the first book, Born in the Borderlands, set in the Byzantine border theme of Chaldea, that's roughly Pontic Turkey, the region in the north, mid-north of Turkey. It's set in the mid 11th century when Byzantine Seleuc tensions are beginning to boil over. And the personal aspect of that conflict is seen through the eyes of Appion, our hero. So Appion's he's a Byzantine boy who's been badly injured and orphaned after his parents were murdered by a Seleuc raiding party. sort of coinless. His home's been burnt down and everything. He ends up falling into slavery and being taken to a grubby tavern in Trebizond, the Chaldean capital. So he's got every right, given what's happened to him, to have carry some sort of hatred for the Seljuks, even if it's not irrational. You can understand why he might do that. But all his prejudices and this respect are challenged when one day an old Seljuk named Mansur comes to Trebizond and buys Appian from the tavern keeper. So Appian's at first suspicious and anxious, unsure of what Mansur has in mind for him. But when they arrive at Mansur's home, that's a farm out in the borderlands, right on the Seljuk Byzantium fault line, he realises that he's actually got nothing to fear. The farm's idyllic. Mansur treats him like a son, teaches him to hunt, to harvest, how to play shatranj, that's an early form of what we call chess, and helps him to overcome his debilitating injuries from the night of the raid. Then Appian comes to love Mansur like a father, and he even falls for Mansur's daughter. But all the while, the tensions between the Byzantine Empire and the Seljuk Sultanate are mounting. And almost daily, Appian sees Imperial Tima cavalry squadrons riding urgently to and fro across the land. The thing is, this is where the conflict comes in. He's the personal conflict. He's torn within because if he was to go to serve in that war, for which side would he fight? He's a soldier. Because he has Byzantine blood, he's found a loving Seljuk family. So this is a bit of a scenic route to get to the answer to the question, but in this respect, this is where the Haga represents Appian, and that with the Haga's two heads are like Appian's two minds and torn loyalties. So,
excellent. Well, we encourage everyone to read the book and to find out more. Well, let's talk about the strict history part. Can you tell the listeners about the kind of research you had to do in order to write about daily life in Byzantium and daily life in the army?
Sure. So primarily being based in Scotland and primarily an armchair researcher, not completely though, as I love Turkey and go there as often as possible. Not in the last few years, unfortunately, given events, but with the pandemic, etc. But yeah, in terms of my bookshelves, obviously John Julius Norwich was the spark, and he laid out the grand arc of events wonderfully for me. And I then turned to the chronicler Michael Italiates. So his history was basically my Bible for the specific goings on of the mid 11th century, and specifically the Manzikert campaign. Even though not everything he says is to be fully trusted, and to be honest, that's often the beauty of history and these panegyrics and invectives and so on, that you find they're loaded with agenda. And that's really good fodder for a writer. in terms of finding out about army life, I was quite surprised by this, but at the time, but the strategic one of Morris dates from the 5th century, so it was several centuries old by the time of Strategos, but it's still largely held good in terms of the basis of military tenets of Appian's time. Obviously not strictly unchanged or anything, but it was the kind of white sauce for military practice even then. But I found that this, there were insights into the developments that had happened since then, covered well by the works of Dregold, Haldon and Angold. They covered the more recent kind of military developments by the likes of Basil II. the super heavy cavalry of that era and the advances in warfare and techniques. And then there's the, in terms of visual inspiration, you can never go wrong with the Osprey series. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're basically packed with detail, text and detail on tables and so on, but wonderful illustrations too. You know, it was a mix of very dry history and very, very juicy history and artwork and things like the Orbis engine. Now that's a map engine. You can find it online just by Googling it, and it gives you a layout of the Roman world, and you can pick any two points, any two cities or forts or major locations between it and work out the journey route and journey time for a typical transit between two places, and it gives you, you know, authentic details of whether the most likely route would have been by sea, by horse, by, you know, by wagon, whatever, by foot. It gives you an estimate of how long it would have taken, so you can add that authenticity to your campaigns and so on, or your messenger riders getting from one place to another, how long would it take, etc. But the highlight, the most exciting part was the regular trips to Turkey. So I'd go there to add the colour and spice and realism to the world of Strathnagos. Just having things like seeing the colours of the sky and the soil, the smell of the heat and the sound of the cicadas, and that's just wonderful. And I even went, so Appian takes up running as a way to get past his physical ailments, and I decided to go for a little run in Turkey. I'm a keen runner in the UK, but let me tell you, running in 40-degree heat is something else entirely.
That's really interesting. I can imagine. And of course, you'd already written books in the Roman period, so you were no stranger to researching and getting in the mindset by that point. Well, I only know what they've got up to in book one. I am looking forward to reading books two and three in the trilogy. Do you think you'd be able to give a spoiler-free hint of where the story might be going to entice listeners?
Sure. So, yeah, book one, Born in the Borderlands. Now, that's all about Appian's coming of age and military ascension. Book two, Rise of the Golden Heart. This is all about news of Appian's military exploits, drawing the attentions of the imperial court. So think about the likes of the widow Eudokia, Michael Selos, and the Ducas dynasty back in Constantinople. They've begun to hear about Appian's triumphs and adventures in the borderlands. So he finds himself summoned to Constantinople. There he's drawn into a lethal game of espionage, where he's got to attempt to thwart conspirators who are plotting to try to prevent Romanus Theophanes, the Golden Heart, as I call him, from the title of the book. They're trying to prevent him from inheriting the imperial throne. So only with Romanus safely on the throne can the empire hope to meet the urgent threat of Alparslan and the Seleuc Sultanate, who by this time are swelling and ready for a renewed assault on Byzantine lands. So that's the gist of book two. And then book three, Island in the Storm, takes Appian to the place and the moment that changed Byzantine and arguably world history forever, Manzikert.
Well, I definitely encourage listeners to check out the book series. There is a gordondoherty.co.uk if you want to buy the books from there. And you also have my Audible link if you'd like to listen to book one as I did. Gordon, can you tell us about some of the other books you've written and that listeners might be interested to check out at your website.
Sure. So, as mentioned before, it's the Legionary series. That's set in Thrace in the 4th century AD. It tells the story of the 11th Claudian. They're a once great legion raised many centuries before by Julius Caesar, another man. But they're now, the Claudia now find themselves reduced to a status of an impoverished border guardian. However, they will find themselves vital in what is to come, because this is the age when the Huns have begun their surge from the steppe lands, pushing a multitude of Germanic and Syrian tribes towards the Empire's borders. So that's the Legionary series. Then there's the Empire's Bronze series. That's set way back in 1300 BC. So it tells the story of the mighty Hittite Empire. So these were an ancient people who carved the Hagar reliefs, as I mentioned earlier, around Anatolia. They were an absolute superpower of the Bronze Age, going toe-to-toe with Pharaoh Ramesses II's Egypt and the Assyrians and the Greeks of Agamemnon. And this series tells the final decades of the Hittite Empire. The Bronze Age is such a strange time because it's so different to our idea of civilization, and the Hittites are particularly strange. For example, we had this tradition where if a husband and wife weren't getting on with some sort of marital dispute, an oracle or a wise woman, as they called them, would get the husband and wife together and advise them both to spit in the mouth of a sheep. So that's one rather odd tradition of Wales. But the story of Empires of Bronze, it follows the adventures of a general prince named Hattusilus, and we know of him from the excavated Hittite tablets. And the story takes in some legendary moments from history: the Battle of Kadesh, the Trojan War, and the truly catastrophic Bronze Age collapse. And then one other series for Roman fans, Rise of Emperors, is co-written by myself and my friend Simon Turney. And it tells the tale of Constantine the Great and his bitter rival, Maxentius. The trilogy is set around the build-up to and the execution of the famous Battle of the Milvian Bridge, another watershed moment in history.
Fantastic. I'm interested in co-authoring there and what that's like. Perhaps you could talk a bit about that with a nice broad question to finish. I get messages from people every few months or so who are contemplating writing Byzantine fiction. As someone who's written a lot and had success, and not wanting to make you talk for too long, but what advice would you give to someone who's starting from scratch if they want to have some success as a historical fiction writer?
I suppose at the core of it, a historical fiction writer is primarily a writer. The earliest pieces of advice that worked for me were in a more broader, generic landscape of how to write, as opposed to how to write historical fiction. And so one thing I would say is, most definitely, be yourself. So to explain, in my early days, I tried too hard to imitate the authors I liked, for example, David Gemmell. It was fun, but it just wasn't authentic. My wife, who's also my chief editor, she pointed this out to me, and it was plain as day when she had. And this totally changed how I approach things. So while I'm still definitely influenced by other authors, I always tell my stories my way, and that makes a massive difference. It makes it your story. And the other thing I'd say is, if you're just starting out, overreaching is something that's a common pitfall. So you don't need to start by writing a great American novel. Flash fiction is a perfect place to start. That could be just a flash fiction, could be like a paragraph, a page, no more than that. Just a bite-sized project. It's a really rapid and powerful way to understand and to tame the raw emotions that come out when you first try to write. If you can get a handle on them within a page or a paragraph, it will stand you in very good stead, for later longer works. And, you mentioned as well the co-authoring thing, and in relevance to that, writing is a very solitary profession, and many introverted people like me might be drawn to writing for that very reason. But trust me, go forth and make friends with fellow writers. You can't fail to learn from them, and they from you. But just look at what my friendship with Simon Tommy resulted in, the published trilogy, as mentioned. What a result that was. In terms of historical fiction in particular, I guess you've got to have a love of detail, but also an understanding that you want to have a broad appeal as well. You don't want to put readers off by being too much of a stickler for detail, by overloading your prose with every single mention of an attested inscription in every wall that your character walks past. It's got to be done at a level that keeps it interesting but PC and accessible and immersive without being overpoweringly historical, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And I can attest that Stratigos, born in the Borderlands, definitely lives up to that. Well, I'm sure anyone seeking more advice will track you down and ask you for more questions. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your wisdom with us.
Yeah, and thank you so much once again, Robin, for having me on. And please keep up the good work with the podcast.
Thank you so much. As I mentioned at the start of the podcast, we're running a competition where you can win book one from the Stratigos trilogy, signed by Gordon Doherty himself. We thought we'd go with a creative question rather than a factual one for this competition. So to win the book, tell us which period of Byzantine history you wish you could time travel to and why. Go to gordondoherty.co.uk and submit your answers on the contact page, and Gordon will judge which is the most interesting or creative answer and will announce the winner at the end of May, which is the deadline for answers. If you prefer to listen to books and somehow have not joined audible.com yet, then why not sign up via my link, audibletrial.com/Byzantium. You get a free month of Audible service, including the chance to keep Stratigos, Born in the Borderlands, forever. And there are also exclusive Audible podcasts you can listen to, as well as the chance to buy other books from Audible's humongous catalogue. Just go to audibletrial.com/Byzantium to sign up.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. have them sing your praises in their own words, and get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book HostRed sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.